how many people went to Exchange last year? How many people saw this presentation at Exchange last year? Okay, this will be some repeated information, but those are also, it's been updated for things that have been bestowed upon me this year, me and my team. So I'm talking about database problems that we encountered in the field. So who am I? Those who don't know me, Mike Burgle, worked at Progress since 1989, always in development. I now run the database group at GradePoint, and GradePoint, everybody know who GradePoint is? Anybody never hear of GradePoint?
No.
Okay, so GradePoint, so when I was doing this at Exchange, Gus told me, he goes, enough about GradePoint. Why don't we talk about things that people may not know about GradePoint? So here's some facts about GradePoint, the largest consulting group in the world. There's 140 employees at GradePoint. That is a pretty substantial number, and these 140 people do nothing but open edge, either development, QAD support, or database work on open edge. It was called USI, founded in 1987. Anybody that's been to Exchange might have heard of the Bunker Test. The Bunker Test was something that Dan Foreman, Gus, and John Harlow kind of came up with to try to get people to migrate to Linux. It was a way to validate that Linux was a good deployment platform. The managed database team has four former Progress employees. This is an unknown thing. Dan Foreman and John Harlow are two people that worked at GradePoint, and they're people that have been using Progress longer than anybody I know. I think John has been doing it using Progress since 1984. And Frere made books with it. So GradePoint's all open edge all the time. So what am I here to talk about? I'm going to talk about stuff that has come to over my desk and my team's desk that we had to deal with over the past 2 years. Coming from a Progress development, wearing a Progress development hat for many, many years, we heard about problems. To be honest, there was times when I was at Progress, I never thought the product ever worked. I think Marie can support me on this. All you ever hear about is problems with tech support. And I go, does this product ever work for anybody? Well, I'm out in the field now, and I find out that 99.999% of the time, this product is up and running and has no issues whatsoever. But
if it wasn't, you wouldn't have us here for the last 20 years.
That's a good point. But what's been interesting for me being in the field is now, unlike my development role, this is a role where I actually get to help customers overcome some of the problems I've had. And so I'm dividing this into three areas that we've come across over the past couple of years: disaster areas, performance problems, and migrations and upgrades. And this is going to be very interactive, by the way. It was designed to be an interactive session. So, disaster area, that looks pretty disastrous, building falling down. So, this is all going to be case studies. I have six case studies. And here's the first case study. A large distribution center had a power failure. When the power came back on, the machine booted up, but the database didn't start. And here's some error messages that they saw in the log file, and I highlighted the key pieces. There's that piece there. What's funny is when I did this Exchange, the person who called us, which I had never met before, I only knew him by name, was sitting about right where you're sitting. And he goes, I know this one, because it had just happened about 3 weeks prior to Exchange. So this is what happened to them. So they started back up, and two of their extents are missing. Error in 02 means file not found. So here's some specifics of it. The database was 80 gigabytes in size. The last good big backup was a week old. You're going to see a trend of this week old stuff. And they did not have after imaging running. This customer was not even aware that after imaging was a feature. And they were on Linux. So the question is, what would you do?
Were all their files, was all the file systems there and everything checked out intact from a file system disk standpoint?
All the file systems were there. So you would think that maybe these files lived in the lost and found directory. That I think might have been explored, but there was nothing there. When I got involved, it was gone.
Are the missing areas, do they hold table data or index
areas? That's a very good question. did the missing table, the missing files, did they hold table data or index data? Well, I told you everything I know at this point, which is this.
I would look at the STP.
Right, so that's a really good thing, good place to start. Look at the ST file, look at the DF file, see if you can get some hint of, is it index data that's missing? So if it's index data that's missing, what would you do?
I would copy the extents from the last time we get back up so that your sites are right, and put them in that location, and then after I kick off the index result.
So the comment was, I would take the last known good backup a week old, restore it somewhere, assuming it's a progress backup, take the extents that are missing, copy them in place, and then try to run an index rebuild. You're gonna have moderate success with that. I think you're down the right path, but there's some things you need to do because it's not gonna just work out of the box. But you're down the right path. Let me tell you what we did. I'm doing the wrong thing. We made a copy of the existing database just in case we made a mistake. So we wanna make sure that anything we do to this environment, if we go down the wrong path, we have the ability to get back. Because the worst thing you're gonna do is go do something on the live environment, make a mistake, and now you're forced to go back to the week-old backup. That's not really the best approach. Use ProStrip List to determine which files were missing. We were lucky that the missing file was part of the storage area that held all the indexes. So we got lucky on this one. So what do we do? The tools available are ProStrip Unlock and BuildDB. We did not do what we suggested, and I wished we did, because it would have been an easier thing. We did ProStruct Unlock to go build empty extents. And that didn't work out as well as we would have hoped.
You had to run ProStruct Unlock anyway because the timestamps and those two.
We had to run ProStruct, so even if we copied the extents from a different location, from an older database, we'd have to run ProStruct Unlock to get the extent headers timestamps to match. But we didn't do that. We just said, okay, do ProStruct Unlock with the magic create files, which I can't remember what it is, to build out empty files. And there's also another command called ProStruct BuildDB. ProStruct BuildDB, if you miss the .db file, it's a way of recreating the .db file. We did in that case, but I just wanted to lay it out as a tool that's capable to help you in these types of situations where you miss some files.
So when you're doing the ProStruct unlock, you're just building the DF file.
When you're doing a ProStruct unlock, it's not building a DF file. This is very physical. This is at the physical layer. So what ProStruct unlock does is it makes sure that all the timestamps match on all the files. And if there's any missing files, you can specify a command to go magically create those files again. Those files being created will have no data in them, but at least it will allow you to open the database. So we did that. So we did ProStruct Unlock. We rebuilt the indexes, but the index rebuild failed because it failed to find, it found bad blocks in the storage area where the records were stored. So we found out that we during this crash we didn't only lose the some files in the database. We also lost some blocks in some files that weren't lost in the database. So now what do you do?
Shoot the hardware
vendor?
Yeah.
So, well, we started over. Because at this point we were like, okay, so index rebuild didn't work. So the problem is, once index rebuild doesn't work, what can you do to the database?
Not much.
You can't even pro-del it.
You can rebuild like a standard
thing or something. Well, you've got to get index rebuild to complete. So we just said, okay, we're done here, let's start over. So we started over, we took the good copy, and then we added the missing extent, we truncated the BI file, and did a DB repair to scan bad blocks and scan bad records, which is exactly down the path that you go on. After the corruption was removed, it was time for us to go do a dump and load. So we did do it, we were successful getting an index rebuild done, but then we had to do a dump and load because we didn't know what corruption we had in the database since we were just formatting some random blocks in the data extents to have nothing in them. So we did the dump and load, we had a dump around corruption, which we did, we know how to do that, you know, for each, and we'll talk more about that later in another one. And then, you know, we ended up advising the customer. I ended up going on site shortly after to this customer to meet them, and went on site and turned on after imaging for them, and taught them a little bit about how to run a enterprise system in deployment. So, you know, they gotta treat their environment better. There's tools to make your environment better. The unfortunate thing for us at Breakpoint is we usually get called when things are bad. So I try to say, okay, this was a disaster, we got through the disaster, now let's do something to prevent the disaster in the future. So a good DR plan would have saved them a lot of headache. So that was case study one. Oh, next step. Implement good disaster plan, frequent backups, after imaging, test it annually. Disaster recovery plan needs to be on paper, can't just be on computer. Because what happens if the computer that the disaster recovery plan was on can't boot? So, how many here are running after imaging? I'm hoping everybody says yes. Anybody here not running after, have a production, but a production data that's not running after imaging? You want to talk about it? Well, come down, we'll have a beer. Sure.
I've got lots of stuff to get done before that.
This is where we can help. Okay. So, testing your disaster recovery plan. How many people actually test the disaster recovery plan annually? Okay, those are important things. Okay, so here's another disaster. This one's a little closer to hardware, all the beers.
That's
really
that's beer.
That's beer. That is beer.
That really is a disaster.
I know.
It that's
made
not data.
Me,
that's
it made
beer.
Me cry.
Back in your other mouth, say one of the things we used to do, we do a little bit different now, but for that tester thing, or we used to do it on a recording copy on a separate machine.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a great place to take full backups over there, if you want to apply after images, etc. And you know, actually moving copies over via tape, you know your tapes are good, you know they'll restore right. Another machine.
So and our customers to emphasize that point, we're saying that when you do a disaster recovery test, you don't need to disrupt your production environment. Typically what happens is we store a database on the same machine in a different location, or maybe you have your DR plan has a separate machine, and you just take one user and have that user go verify that they can do some functions. They can print, they can do all the functions they need, and then once you're satisfied, you just tear down the system and know that you're good. Okay, second case study. A brand name US bank has sand corruption. So this prevented crash recovery from completing. Crash recovery is whenever you shut down the database, no matter how you shut it down, it's gonna do an integrity check on the way up. It's gonna go make sure that all the data blocks are current. If there was a crash, it will then go undo any open transactions just to make sure that the database is transactionally intact. So, they couldn't go through crash recovery. They had a hot standby machine and they were using OE replication. So they have all the right things. So what's the problem? They had a local backup and local AI files, but for some reason the backup would not restore. We tried to restore it several times and it would get about 23% through and it would say enter next device. Or we'd do another time, it would get 35% through, it would say get next device. We don't know why that happened. We suspect it might have been a problem with the progress release, or it might have been that the backups, when it was reading blocks, the SAM was just giving it empty blocks, and when you get an empty block, maybe this was the way the store works. The previous backup wasn't available because these guys have open edge replication. They're thinking that's their solution. The replica database was up to date. So the replica database over remotely on another machine in another geographic location was current. Platform was Windows, database was 50 gigabytes. So what's the problem here? Sounds like everything's good, right? What's the problem? In this case, they refused to fail over. So I get this happened to our customer, and the crash happened on Friday, late night somewhere, I think I was traveling. I came home, and I took my kids to the water park. They were all excited about this, and I get the phone call about 2 o'clock. I'm at the water park, and kids are running around everywhere, and I'm on the phone with this bank for 2 hours, and I'm saying to them, if you're not going to fail over now, you guys have been down for almost a day now. If you have sand corruption, you can't get through crash recovery, you have open entry application. If you're not going to fail over now, when will you fail over? You know, what's the compelling reason to get you guys to fall over, to fail over? But the problem is they never, ever fully tested their disaster recovery plan. So they didn't have enough faith that they could get all the operations of their business running in the failover environment. And then if they failed over, because they were confident about the database, they were worried about app servers and all these auxiliary processes, they didn't know how they were gonna fail back. Because the geographic distance between the production and the remote site was pretty large, 50 gigabytes doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but moving that across the WAN, their WAN speed wasn't enough that they said, okay, we're gonna fail over there, how are we gonna get back? One option would have been, okay, so they have this database on the replica, back up that database and pull that back. That was estimated to be eight or nine more hours by the time I got the call. Or measurement days. I mean, it was a long time. Now here's where the problems start. And this happened before I got on the phone. So options presented to management were, okay, here's what we can do. We can fail over. Another option is we can take that backup that's at the failover site. We can back that up and copy it back over here. It's going to take this long. But I looked over there and I saw that there were no open transactions on the DR site, so we could force into the database. Everybody know what forcing into the database means? Has anybody ever forced into a database before? I've only done that in development progress. I have not done that for any live customers. So that was presented to the management. So management's sitting here going, I got three options, is what I'm told. Option number one, fail over, which I have no faith in. Option number two, be down for another half a day to a day. Option number three, do some magic fairy dust called forcing in, and I'll be up in minutes. Which one do you think they chose? So they forced into the database, and I was just, oh my God. You know, knowing what goes on under the covers, I was just stunned.
Does replication continue at all if you force your way in?
No.
Or does that now push prep?
At this point, everything has to be torn down. Okay, so once you force in, AIs, everything at this point it has torn down, you've got to rebuild from scratch. That's not really the issue. That's recoverable. The issue is, so there's this whole magic, go rebuild an index and life will be good, right? And it's not, right? So index rebuild does not fix this database. This database now has permanent corruption in it. Dump and load does not fix the database. Dump and load is going to make the database better. So it'll be physically intact. But logically, at this point, who knows? You've lost data. At this point, you may have order and order lines. This is a bank. Maybe you have, I don't know what they have. I think this is a mortgage application. So you may have mortgage and mortgage rows that aren't really connected to each other, or missing mortgage rows. So it could be that somebody's, you know, loan origination kind of went sideways on this, and they never know, even after a dump and load. We did subsequently dump and load this database, so at least we have confidence that it's not going to crash because of any physical problems. But that was a surprise. So what's the lesson learned here? Have confidence in your disaster recovery plan. I mean, for these guys, I mean, why buy open edge replication? It costs money. Why go through the effort of keeping this up and running if you never have any intention of using it? And this was the big takeaway. Do not present the quick fix, because people that don't know will always opt for the easiest way out, and they consider this to be the easiest way out. So they won't understand what the consequences are. Disaster. So what do we do? working with the customer to get them to do a failover test and make it an annual event. So next time, in the event that something like this happens, they'll have confidence and they can say, yes, it's time to pull the trigger. Can't tell you how many times in my world, and I've got some people on my team here in our world, that people have a disaster and they are afraid to pull the trigger to restore backup. They just want you to fix the problem, fix the problem. So how many people have ever restored a backup in production? Matt, you've done everything. You forced in. Wait, if you forced in, why did you restore the backup?
Well, it's not the same
system. Oh. Right. So people have actually restored and rolled forward?
Yep.
Good. This will be a new one. Because I get more modern pictures now. Case study 3. This one happened about 4 weeks ago to us. So this is new from last year, the UMR. So a large school district down in Texas needs to get the report cards out to 30,000 students. Now, I want to tell you a little aside. My little school where I live, we've got 34 students in the whole entire school, K through 8. 30,000 students. I'm like floored by this. But it's a school district. They discovered that they had corruption in the database because the backup stopped working, and it took them about a week to discover that the backups weren't working. So the backups were running, and then they all of a sudden stopped. Nobody was aware of it. Next day stopped. Nobody really caught the fact that they stopped. Next day stopped. Eventually somebody goes, where's the backup? You know, how come the backup's so small? And so they found that out. Here's some specifics. They were 10.2B05 on Windows 64-bit OpenEdge. So this is the native Windows 64-bit product. Last good backup was a week old. All report card data for the 30,000 students had been entered in since the last good backup. Now you gotta think about this. So these are school teachers, these are admins, these are, you know, and it's a whole bunch of different schools. It's not one school with 30,000 people in it. So this is the school district software. And these guys are like, oh my God, we cannot have these people have to re-enter all this data. Report cards were due out on Friday. They called me on Friday at 10 in the morning. Okay. I'm like, oh, hey, they have after imaging turned on. But the after imaging retention was less than a week, and they were not backing up the after image files. They figured, no need, right? We're going to have, we got our backups, right? Database was not small. Database was 300 gigabytes. And the good news is they had that 1 week old backup restored to a different location. So now we got two things to play with here. So they got me involved. They've been fighting for this. They've been fighting over this for a day or two. The guys I was dealing with hadn't slept. They were exhausted. So given that scenario, here we go. You want to take another shot at this? What would you do?
I guess I'd run a table analysis for both environments, see where the difference in records are, start trying to jump from the corrupted database to see where your errors are.
Okay, let me repeat what you said. So you'd write a table analysis on both databases, see if there's what records are different, and see if you can reconcile. That's about where you're heading?
Yeah.
Well, table analysis on the database that can't back up is going to fail because it can't back it up because it's running to 1124 errors. So the table analysis will not complete the report because the way table analysis works is it goes and scans the whole entire database, and then it dumps out your data. So you've lost the table analysis on the live database because of the same reason for the backup. But that's good. We're heading down that path. I like your thinking. Right? We are heading down that path. Anybody else have any thoughts? You guys can't talk.
I know.
Okay. What's that?
What about dump and load?
So dump and load, right? So we got to dump and load the data. So that's clearly part of the formula here is on that production database to dump and load the data. But let me move us forward here. So we ended up having two plants. And this helped them a lot because these guys have been up for over 24 hours. They had a really tough time seeing the forest for the trees. They were in the weeds and they were just fighting. So I really kind of came in as a kind of a process saying, we got two plans here. Plan A, let's get the production database back up. That's got the 30,000 report cards in it. That's important to do. But I told these guys right from the start, there's no guarantees on anything here. They're like, we're okay with plan B. If we have to go back to the schools and have them re-enter, we're gonna look like dirt, we might lose them, but we could go that way, we just don't want it. So the goal for plan B was to see if they could get the report card data out of the plan A database and put it into the plan B database. So the plan B database was the week old database. So this is gonna be down the path of, let's dump data and try to figure out how we could get this all put together, right? Okay, so the database log file showed the extent, so I'm on plan A. So the database log file showed the extent where the corruption was located, just like last time. We had missing extents, now we have 1124, the extent happens to be, storage area, blah, or file number D1, right? Underscore 7D1. Each storage area was a single variable length extent. Not a fan. Just gotta say it, not a fan. I am not a set it and forget it type of guy. And here's why. The corruption was an 80 gigabyte extent. So now I gotta go and run DB repair on this thing and scan it, and to go find corruption in this thing, it's 80 gigabytes. It took 3 hours before it failed. And when it failed. It got as far as it went, 3 hours later, just crashed. If these extents were 20 gigabyte extents, I know which extent it's in. The error message tells me which extent it's in. And when DB repair says, which extent do you want to scan? I had no options. I could only scan the one storage area, the one extent of storage area. So I am not a fan of set it and forget it, not at all. My team, I got members of my team here, they know this. We manage 1,000 databases on probably 150 different machines. Set it and forget it doesn't work for us. I mean, how can we manage if there's any disk space on those machines or not? We have no ability to do this. So this drives me crazy. So this didn't work. So at the end, I tried it twice. So 3 hours, gone. 3 hours, gone. And it might not have been 3 hours, but it felt like 3 hours. Probably more like 90 minutes. Maybe the whole thing was 3 hours. Couldn't get it to work. It might have been because it was Windows 64. It might have been because it was 10.2.B.05. There could have been many reasons, but we're now scrambling, and plan A is now dead. So I told them, plan A is dead. You know, the tools I have to go do this aren't working. We're on Windows. If we're on Linux, you know, maybe with my knowledge of the database, we could have gone and done some awful dumps of the data, but and played some games. But even that, I think that's brain surgery. The end result is not gonna be what you want. So plan B, here's what we did. We worked with the vendor to find the tables that made up the report card processing. Now, you'd think report card, single table, not hard, right? No, of course not, right? So there's 12 tables involved. So here's what we did. We dumped those 12 tables, binary dumped those 12 tables out, and those dumped clean. No problem, no errors, we're in good shape. So now I've got these binary dump files. And they could have been ASCII dump files. What can I do with these files? How can I get these into the Plan B database?
You take those, you make yourself a temporary database, you load them in so you have something to work with, and you can programmatically connect to those databases, see what you need to do, pull stuff over.
That's a great suggestion. I'm going to repeat that. So you take those binary dump files, you take the schema definitions, you load them into another database, and now you have a database with these 12 tables in them, and then you write some program to go check back and forth to see if they're there, right? Great suggestion, not the path we chose.
You can use SQL drop table to drop the tables from the database and just turn around and load the app and shuffle the tables back in.
So you could use SQL to do a drop table, and then from there you could then load the DF and load it back in. That probably would work. SQL's a three-letter word to me. I wouldn't even know how to spell a drop table. So not the approach we took, but I think that one would work. The key here is these tables, some of them were very large. Some of these tables are multi-gigabyte tables. So how long would it take to drop a table is the question.
It's instant.
It's instant, okay.
It's quick.
So we
it's
didn't.
So fast that you can make a typo and you can't even get your curse word out before that's
I got a better one.
I'm ready.
I got a better one.
I'm not ready.
You go ahead and you make yourself another area in the database.
Another area.
You modify your double your schema file, change the table name.
Yeah.
You use your binary dumps, You load it in, and then you go rename the original tables and the other one to old blah, blah, blah. You make change the one that was the new one to the regular, and now you're running with those 12 tables in a different area. You split your thing a little bit, and away you go.
It's like you almost read the screen. So that's similar but different. So what we did, we dumped the schema for those 12 tables. We went into the dictionary and renamed the tables to table name underscore old. So now we're not dropping the tables. The data is still there. It's just not going to be referenced by anything. Then we loaded the schema for those 12 tables, loaded the data for the 12 tables, and they were off and running. No CRC failures. This just all works. Obviously, we did a test on demo first just to make sure I could convince them of this. But they needed to be convinced of this. This is a very nifty trick. Now, they have a whole bunch of orphan data in the database that they're never going to reference, but at least it got them to get the report cards out, which was the goal.
The cleanup of that, though, is easy because
over time,
you can run some delete programs over time, empty those tables out, and then when you get a maintenance window, I go ahead and delete the table that's got no records in it, bing, bang, boom, done.
Exactly. So you can deal with this after report cards are out and kids are happy or sad, yes. But let's go back to plan A. So now the approach was plan A, failed. Plan B, get report cards out. Well, now that they're at least over the hurdle, let's take a deep breath and say, can we do anything so to get plan A going? So we went back to plan A, and the solution here was just to dump and load plan A. So we just dumped and loaded plan A. There were five tables that when we dumped, those five tables hit 1124 errors. So those five tables I did for each dump, for each five field, and it was very convenient. They had an index field that was that they had one index that was unique, that was a single component, so it made it really easy for me to do this without having to know anything. So I reached this way, reached that way. Table analysis, the record counts were so far off, they didn't trust those five tables. So what did we do? We used the same technique for these five tables. They, with the vendor, knew that these five tables were kind of support tables, not a big deal. So we dumped those five tables out of the week-old database and used the same technique to bring those into the current database. They were off and running. And the report cards were shipped. But wait, there's more. When it rains, it's poor, of course. So here's this customer. They just went through this disaster, engaged us, had mud on their face. Report cards did not get out on Friday. They got out on Monday, but at least they got out. And then a week later, they had a financial database that also had corruption in the database. So it's on a separate machine, probably on the same SAN, similar corruption. However, this one was not as dramatic. This one had a very happy ending. So they called me. The DBAs on site were pretty good. They had sleep. They had a whole week, so they were better. So they were restoring a backup, but roll forward was not working. And it just wouldn't work. They would roll forward. I'm like, this isn't hard. Just go forward. And roll forward would crash, and then they'd roll forward the second one, third one, they'd all say wrong version number, right? And so I'm like, well, this should be working, but you gotta remember, they're on Windows 64-bit. 10.2b was the first real commercial shipment of Windows 64-bit. It had some issues. So we upgraded them to 10.2b08 from 10.2b05, and magically roll forward worked for them. So this one had a very happy ending because it didn't cost me my weekend and a lot of money and no data loss at all. So what's the next steps? So here's my issue with this customer is I'm worried that this is going to happen again and again and again. They have some sort of underlying problem that we don't know what the problem is. So they need to implement some sort of DR solution. OE replication, rolling forward AI, I don't care what it is. They just need to do something because they're just sitting here waiting for this to happen again. So we could restore the backup and move forward on the same machine. This would verify that the backup's functional. DB block corruption does not get replicated. this is something that happens when you write the block. It's at the right time of the block that that the corruption occurs. It's not when you're sending stuff over a network or writing to the AI file. However, as Brian Goldman told me, even on the same machine, there's a license cost. I had a chance to buy because I didn't think there was. But there's a license cost with restoring on the same machine and going forward from a DR standpoint. So there are some costs associated with this, but I'm sure those costs are probably cheaper than me. Talk to Brian. Okay. Talk to Brian Bowman about the licensing aspect.
That doesn't make any sense.
Talk to Brian.
Yeah.
Or even worse, I'm doing a license audit talk tomorrow. But I'm just the messenger there, too. Okay, so now we're going to talk about performance. So case study four. Customer bought a new Linux machine to upgrade the old Linux machine. The machine has more memory, 256 gigabytes of memory to be exact. They bought 8 of these machines too. They made a significant investment. They just didn't buy one. They convinced management that this is the way we're going, and they bought 8 machines with solid state disks, 256 gigabytes of memory, and a whole bunch of CPU. I'm talking like 64 CPUs or some ridiculous number of CPUs. And they went, management said, got it, let's go, put this in place. They put it in place, and the application runs slower on this new hardware. SSD drives, lots of memory, lots of CPU. The CPUs were not busy. You do TOP, you do SAR. They were idle, all of them, idle. The system load is high. You know, if you do uptime, or on top, you can see the load up on the right-hand side. It's ridiculously high. It's like 60 to 80%. And they say when the problem occurs, this is a symptom of it. Why is the load so high? You look at the disks, not busy. You look at the CPU, not busy. What's going on? So the application was sluggish, and you couldn't find any process that was chewing up a CPU or anything. It was just this bizarre thing where the machine is just basically melting, but the CPUs are idle, disks are idle, and the application's slow. Non-uniform memory architecture. So they bought these machines, and these machines ended up being multi-core machines on a thing called NUMA. So what NUMA looks like is, this is a machine right here with its four cores and its memory. This is a machine right here with its four cores and its memory, so on and so forth. And there's a high-speed connection between all these things, but this little yellow piece here is the bus. So this is the fastest path to this memory. And this is a high-speed interconnect to connect this, basically, machine with this machine. So that's what they had. They didn't know that they had that, but that's what they had. And it took a lot of convincing. You can imagine the conversations they had with these guys. I mean, they just bought 8 of these machines. So there's a problem called cache coherency, or cache coherence. Now, it's just in Dan Foreman's talk before this, and Rich Bandel called it a ping pong. I'm not sure what ping pong is all about, but cache coherency, Google cache coherence. You'll find thousands of documents talking about cache coherence. So what cache coherence is, OpenEdge needs to gain exclusive access to a region of memory. It's called a latch. We're going to lock memory somehow, or they're going to lock memory somehow. We're going to stop with that weak thing. A test is performed to see if that region's locked. So that test is going to operate on one of these guys, one of these CPUs, and it's going to go look in memory, wherever the memory is, to see if it's locked. Well, as you scale wide, all the cache lines of all the CPUs need to stop what they're doing and say, make sure my cache line does not hold any data that this one CPU is going to see if it's locked. So they all have to go query the cache line and say, nope, don't have the data. So all those cache lines have to be synchronized. So as CPUs scale out wide, the cache coherency problem gets worse and worse and worse. So as you move to big 128 CPU machines, think about this. You get all those CPUs are busy. They spend all their time doing this cache coherency check So you don't see any time in system time, you don't see any time in user time, you don't see any time in wait on IO. It was just, the CPUs are idle because it's all cache coherence that's going on. Matt, you got a question?
Yeah.
Comment?
I bet you guys checked the VMstack, right?
Yes, we did check the VMstack as well. So, the other part about Numerant that's key, so you got, not only do you have the cache coherence problem, you also have something called far memory reads. So shared memory is going to span across all those CPUs. Let me go back to the picture. So you're going to go allocate a buffer pool. And these guys had 256 gigabytes of memory, so guess what they did? That's big B of 200 gigabytes, right? They wanted all the memory. It's the right thing to do. They were modern version of Progress. So some shared memory's here, some shared memory's here, some's over here, some's over here, right? So now you're going to go modify something in shared memory, and you're on the CPU, and you're modifying something here. That's great. That's really close. You're on the yellow. That's the bus. That's really, really fast. Next time you modify something, you're on the CPU, but you got to go over here. It means you've got to go across this interconnect to get there. And that's what's called the NUMA quotient. So when the NUMA quotient is 1, that means you're on an SMP machine, a non-NUMA machine. That means that's the fastest path to memory. When the NUMA quotient is not 1, that means that you're on a NUMA machine, so that means that the path to get to memory is bigger than 1. And typical NUMA quotients are about 3. So that means it takes 3 times longer to access memory on a other node, and that's what they call these things. You get multi-node NUMA pieces. So it takes 3 times longer to access memory in the other node than it does locally. So with this in mind, you can Google and you'll see OpenEdge, not a big fan of NUMA. Oracle, not a big fan of NUMA. SQL Server, not a big fan of NUMA. MySQL, not a big fan of NUMA. NUMA does not work well for database systems just because of the common memory that multiple processes have to deal with. So what are some solutions? And this problem is an existing problem, and you can imagine my name when I suggested some of this stuff. But so change the operating mode to client server. Why? Why would that make things better? Because you have less processes access to shared memory, less processes faking latches, less processes doing these fire memory reads. So that's one way to deal with this. That'll help with the cache coherency piece. Disable CPUs. Boy, they were thrilled to hear that one from me. They had eight of these machines. I said, give me a machine. I said, I'm not going to believe for this. I'm just give me a machine. So they gave me a machine for about 4 days, and I used the ATM benchmark. You guys know what the ATM benchmark is. So it's a benchmark that Gus wrote way back when, Progress Maintains. And I used that benchmark, and I was able to reproduce the load of 60 or 80. So I got that reproduced, and then I just started turning off CPUs. And I didn't have enough time, so I just did a wholesale, okay, you've got 64 CPUs, I'm gonna bring you down to 32 CPUs. And once you know, the load went down and the amount of throughput I was able to get through was doubled. So I gave this to them. Oh, you don't want to convince me, Brian. I already threw you under the bus.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Run away.
Oh, he did come in. So we disabled the CPUs, brought it from 64 CPUs to 32 CPUs. The load went down, and the throughput doubled. And I presented this to them, and they are still not happy with me. And I'm like, I'm just the messenger here. You bought a machine that's not really working for your environment. So I'm telling them, the advice I'm giving them is this advice. They still have not dealt with this issue. They've dealt with the application changes to make this better, but they're still struggling here. And I think I finally convinced them in the last month or two that disabling CPUs might be the right way to go. And it's a simple thing to do. This Unix has a command that you echo 0 into a bunch of /proc/CPU or something like that to turn them off. So they're actually going to go down that road, but that's a really tough sell for the manager. Tom? I'm gonna make this comment. So coming back to this picture, which is an important picture, is Tom had a situation. So he was able to bind the broker CPU, the broker process to a single node. Shrunk down shared memory so it is guaranteed to fit in that node. Now, it depends on the APIs and the commands available to you to do this. Now, think in HP, I talked to the people at HP back when they had the integrity systems, those were the ones that were doing that. And they said, yeah, there's ways you can do this. The problem you might have, and you gotta be careful of, is you put the broker on this node, and it then spawns a server. And unless, if there's some special sauce in order to get that server on the node, you've got to make sure the server has that special sauce. Otherwise, the database server is going to go on this node, and it doesn't help you. We had another customer that was doing that, and we were trying to disable CPUs, and they were on Windows, and you couldn't do it because if you disable CPUs, you end up losing the memory that was associated with CPUs. So they had the cache coherency problem, but they needed the memory. And they were willing to deal with fire reads because it wasn't really a performance issue. I mean, it was a performance issue, but they were willing to accept the fire reads. They just wanted to get rid of this CPU. But on Windows, the mode was you turn off the CPU, and maybe it's in the firmware or something, you turn off the CPU, you lose the memory associated with it. So they couldn't work because their application needed the memory. So. Yes. So the comment here is HP on Titanium has some special sauce to bind the process and any children process to an environment. And they also have the special sauce to limit memory to a single node. Linux, I don't believe, has that. So anyways, that was an interesting problem. So I caution all you people who are buying machines. This is going to be a common problem more and more and more. As you scale wide on CPUs, it's just glorious. You can spend $10,000 on a machine and get 128 CPUs. Seems like a great deal, right? It's like, wow, it may not be what you want. You know, so you got to be careful. You got to make sure it's not NUMA. Okay, migrations and upgrades and funny pictures. Okay, so case 75, large warehouse distribution center is migrating from an old machine to a new machine. They have no downtime. Their downtime window is they reboot their environment every night, and that's the only downtime. Lucky that it's AIX to AIX. Database is 500 gigabytes, and it takes 6 hours to copy this to the new machine. And this is all on LAN. They blocked out a 2-hour window for the data migration. Remind you, it took 6 hours to migrate the data. So they've given us 2 hours to do the migration. Okay? So thank you very much for your support.
And also the migration had to be done at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, thank you.
Don't forget that.
Yeah, since Joe did the migration had to be done at 3 o'clock in the morning too. So it wasn't just 2 hours, it was from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. But that's your job, Joe. So what do we do?
That's right. Oh, I love my job.
What do we do? So when you're doing a migration like this, you test. That's real important. We migrated the application files, the system files, and all the other files. And in this case, as we're going through the migration, we found problems. Like we found term info problems from way, way back when in term cap problems. Test some more. I think we're running out of time, so we'll go a little fast. So what do? We stored a backup. We roll forward, and we had, after imaging, keeping that secondary database in sync for about 2 days before the migration. Sorry, maybe you might have been out of license compliance for 2 days. Sorry, Brian. During the cutover period, we only had to transfer the last AI file and apply it. And so that allowed us to fit within the 2-hour downtime window. So that was our solution to the problem. It was you read about this, you see this, it seems like, yeah, it's pretty obvious. To the customer, it wasn't obvious at all. To us, it was like, this was a straightforward thing. The the customer was very panicked about this. He's like, I don't know how we're going to do this. It's a 6 hours to migrate the database, but the business is only giving me 2 hours. And he was very panicked about this. Okay, my last story. Case study number 6. The customer has replication in place using AI files. The end user of the application partner who does frequent updates to the application. Application partner is aware of the DR machine and updates to the DR machine, but this causes problems in snow windows. The application personnel that does the upgrades has a script, and whether that script is a batch file or it's a step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, doesn't have a lot of room outside of the script. So the script at time needs to connect to the database to maybe make a schema change or maybe make some data changes. So the problem here is they go and do this on production, and then they say, okay, I know about the DR machine now, so I'm going to go do this on DR. They do this on the DR machine, they go connect to the database, and it goes through crash recovery. They make the same schema changes that they made on production, and it's over, right? And when I talk about these guys do this often, at one point they were doing these application upgrades every 10 days. So then the customer call us and say, you know, this thing's broken again. Okay, we'll fix it. And then 10 days later, the thing's broken again. So we had to come up with a solution. So, and the database was 80 gigabytes, it's on a WAN, so re-baselining things, this was just a pain. And then we got rid of it. We were doing it all the time from now. But there had to be a better way. So we tried this. We tried to use the op lock and op unlock commands. Who knows about these commands? Who's ever heard of these commands before? This is the best known secret or unknown secret of modern OpenEdge. This allows you to make sure that nobody can connect to that database and ruin your DR database so you don't have to re-baseline. It will not allow you to connect. So the way you do it is you do a roll forward and you do op lock and you roll forward the first one. After that, nobody else can connect to this database. Only roll forward can go connect to this database. Beautiful command, didn't solve the problem. Like I said, loved it. Theory, this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Didn't solve the problem. Because that support engineer that's doing the upgrade has the script. And the script says, go connect to the database and go run this. He goes to connect to the database, gets an error, and he goes, okay, now what? And he just aborts. So hence the rest of the application upgrade didn't work. So you got the application upgraded on production, and you got a half upgrade on DR because you don't know, were they doing more application changes after they connected to the database? Were they doing, did they connect first, did they connect second? So the DR machine had no knowledge of how that code was. So what we ended up having to do was provide a secondary database as a backup of the Replica DR. So we used the no recovery switch to make that backup. And what we did, you know, again, we're dealing with an engineer who just knows where things are all the time. We made the DR database a separate location, so they didn't even know what the DR database was. So we had all the scripts that were rolling forward to a database that they had no visibility in whatsoever. And they would, whenever they did the upgrade, they would take their production, their where they thought the DR copy of the database was, and they would just have to marry away with it, and they would do whatever they needed to do with it, and we would just throw that thing away after. And then we make a new copy and say, okay, we're ready for your next upgrade. So they were able to complete the upgrade, the database was thrown away, and they never heard their replica. Okay, so that's the presentation. So these were 6 case studies of things that has happened to us at Breakpoint in the last 2 years. So don't assume things can't go wrong, that's for sure. And having a plan is not good enough. I think that's the message here. Having a plan is not good enough. You got to test that plan. There were, like I said, several times in my time here in 2.5 years, we've had customers that had really solid DR plans but were not willing to go pull the trigger. And if all helps, this is why we're here. Okay, thank you. Any questions, I'll be here, but you know what? Let's go down to the expo and we'll be there.
One, since I hear replication going anyhow, they should have just made up something to automatically sync the application files over from the one machine to the other, not have the engineer touch the other machine at all.
Yeah, I know.
That would have made a lot more sense.
I would agree with that, but you know, sometimes you don't with people that have egos and they think they know everything.
It sounds like one of these people too needed the further follow-up would have been to move the database off those doggone Windows machines.
Well, yeah. Something real. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the application vendor.
Right.
We're talking to customers all the time as you're upgrading hardware, and I knew nothing about it. Windows machine.
Yep.
Is that something they've got to ask about? You know, it's like, are you sure?
So here's my recommendation. If you got to know how many cores, and you have to know how many CPUs. Okay. If you are more than four CPUs, if you're like eight CPUs with, you know, four cores each, I get worried. I get worried about new
models. I've got these guys that have these fire-breathing dragons, and I'm really wondering.
Hey, Mark, you're a hardware guy. So he's asking this question of, so if you find a machine, how do you know if it's newer or not?
We have dozens of, the titanium
ones. So most of these machines can only have four, each node can only have four CPUs.
Okay.
That's the way it typically works. So if you get a quad core, four CPU, you can have 16 CPUs.
I'm thinking about guys who have machines that are 16 CPUs and have no idea.
Right, sure,
going on.
Sure. So on Windows.
16 CPUs or 16 cores?
Right.
It could be a quad.
Absolutely. Right, quad cores are good. Here's the way to tell.
Okay.
If you're on Windows, go in the Task Manager, and in one of the settings, one of the top menus, you can go View, and then it'll say Numa Node.
Oh, okay.
So you'll have 16 CPU windows, so it's in the performance one. And you can say View Numa Node, so it'll shrink it from 16 CPU little windows graphs to four.
To one of the nodes.
And if you've got Numa Nodes, take the thing and just check it off and check it out the window. Or you know what you can use it for is VMware. It'd be a great ESX host.
Well, okay? That's what I'm saying.
Likewise, there's a command.
But that causes a whole host of other problems.
I was going to say, don't you have a similar situation in a VM environment?
Not unless you scale the virtual CPU. Yes, you do. He doesn't remember it.
Maybe I don't remember it.
Unless you scale the number of virtual CPUs, then you won't have the issue. So if you set up a machine, you give it four virtual CPUs, you'll have no problem.
Okay.
Cache coherency will be manageable.
Okay.
But it's, and we, both of us, we did this test with a customer where they started scaling virtual CPUs. They went up to 16 and to 24 and to 32 and just to see what would happen. And the performance took a nosedive.
Okay, I have people who buy these fire-breathing dragons and have no idea.
Well, this is what
they don't do enough research.
Well, exactly.
They don't, what
And the guy, most, the guy's selling the hardware, I'll sell it to
him. Oh yeah.
What most people don't realize is that 4 to 8 CPUs, no matter, you know, cores or whatever, is gonna be fine as long as you give memory. 256 gigs of RAM and your machine is gonna scream.
But that brings us back to Memwell. We said let's go disable some Numa nodes, and when they disabled them, the memory went with it.
Yeah.
So they could only have.
That depends on the architecture.
So the
operating system.
No, it's So when we just, so we tried to figure it, we played around and tried to figure this out. This requires downtime, right? So we got to boot it into firmware and play and look around. So we were, you know, a little bit constrained on time, but we couldn't figure out how to get the Numa nodes out, get the CPUs out, but leave the memory. We couldn't figure it out. And then at the end of the day, they just gave up and bought a new machine. That's what they did.
That was a huge company for them. Substantially.
Right.
Oh, I just, you know, because you see these guys, you know, they're making decisions one-time purchase, you know, and
this is
going to
last.
And it's not going to happen
five years, right?
4 years, right?
This is them. They're going, listen, I'm going to get the biggest machine I can get, as much memory as I can get, as many CPUs as I can get, and all the SSD drives I can get, because it's going to last me the next 5 years. And you find out the memory's good, the SSDs, party on, CPUs not so much. You know, so it's a dangerous game.
Windows, you don't seem to have the granular control that you seem to have.
I think it might be dependent on the machine. Well,
yeah,
okay,
it depends on the flavor of Unix, right?
Since you fed me down this road, yes, never run any database, OpenS database on Windows, ever. Okay, since you're going to lead me down the path, I'll say
that's not an official Breakpoint quote.
Yes, it is.
I waffle on that.
No, here's what you say. If you're going in cold and you have a choice, I would always choose to be at a non-Windows platform for the database.
Yes,
assuming that the company has talent in-house to support it.
You know what? No. I wouldn't even agree with that.
Outsource that.
Yeah, that's
outsource that.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway,
that's our business. Outsource it. You know,
I had a guy that thought shutting down the Linux box was flipping the switch off in the front, which says a lot for the file system,
but
it's not the method.
It's pretty robust now, though.
Yeah.
Typically what happens is you turn that thing off and it will start a shutdown thing. It's hard. The only way you can actually get these machines to actually hard shut is by pulling the plug. And even then, sometimes that doesn't work because they have some battery backup that lasts 20 minutes. You know, so it's really, really hard now just to say, yank, and see the thing crash. Usually you press the button and it starts shut down. What's that?
So this is my point.
If you end up getting a machine that has 64 CPUs, which is ended up 4 16 core, you know, 4 quad cores, and it's all NUMA, well, just repurpose the machine to be an ESX server. Mm-hmm. And it can go host a whole bunch of stuff, and you know, just don't have to be.
Well, that's where I see a lot of organizations. I mean, kind of size of databases and performance they need, four cores will do anything that they need to do. You know,
especially modern day right now, four cores is pretty fast.
So we just recently went through a migration with a customer that did that. They bought a big piece of hardware and turned it into a virtual server, and then they ran into disk issues.
What is this?
ServiceWire.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's Whole another thing.
Because of the virtual architecture.
Okay.
So there's decisions to be made.
Yes.